Yep. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the BizSpark show. This is the Microsoft show for startups. We interview leading investors, leading startup founders, and bootstrap founders every week to figure out what they're doing in the space and to offer advice to other founders out there as they get started on their intrepid journey to change the world. I'm your host, Douglas Kretz, and we're very happy to have today on our 34th show a man that kind of needs no introduction, but I will do that for the sake of clarity. His name is Brad Feld. He's the managing director of Foundry Group. He's been an early stage investor and entrepreneur since 1987. Prior to co-founding Foundry Group, he co-founded Mobius Venture Capital. And prior to that, he founded Intensity Ventures. He is a co-founder of Techstars, probably the best accelerator program in the world. In addition to his investing efforts, Brad has been active with several nonprofit organizations. He's currently chair of the National Center for Women in Information and Information Technology, co-chair of Startup Colorado. He's based in Boulder, Colorado, and has a Bachelor of Science and Master of Science degrees in Management Science from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, also known as MIT. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you a marathoner and a wonderful investor and great guy, Brad Feld. Welcome, Brad.
Thanks. Delighted to be here.
Great. You have a book that's coming out, so I want to just give you a quick plug for that. It's called Startup Boards, Reinventing the Board of Directors to Better Support the Entrepreneur. That is on pre-order for Amazon. Do you want to quickly tell us what that book is about and why you wrote it?
Yeah, it's the fourth book in the Startup Revolution series that I've been working on. The first book was called Startup Communities, which is about creating an entrepreneurial ecosystem in your city. The second one was Startup Life, which was about having a relationship and surviving and thriving in a relationship with an entrepreneur. The third was written by Matt Blumberg, who's the CEO of a company called Return Path, called Startup CEO. And Startup Boards is about dynamics with boards of directors. I've been on hundreds of boards.
Right.
And some are very functional, many are not. And I thought it was time to take a step back at the early stage and venture-backed board dynamic and put some constructive wrapper around it. And my hope is that anybody who's both a board member or an entrepreneur can get some benefit out of the book.
Yeah, and I hope so too. I've been reading some of your books in preparation for the interview, and I've really enjoyed the fact that you and the people that you co-write the books with are extremely clear and very commonsensical about how to get something started in this kind of ecosystem. An ecosystem, by the way, that is currently going through a kind of a seismic shift. You recently threw your hat into the ring with the AngelList's syndicate structure. Do you want to say a little bit about why you chose to do that and exactly what that's going to mean for you and for Foundry Group going forward?
Sure. Yesterday, my partners and I launched a syndicate on AngelList called FG Angels. For those not familiar with what AngelList syndicates are, it's a way for other AngelList members to participate in investments with a lead of the syndicate. So we're the lead of the syndicate, and people can commit to participate in our syndicate. We committed to do 50 investments over the next 15 months, so between now and the end of 2014. We're investing $50,000 in each company, and we're putting together a syndicate that'll invest another $450,000 in each company. So the funding coming from us plus our syndicate is $500,000. And again, across 50 companies, so about a $25 million total investment amount.
Okay. Yeah, and for any background for people who aren't familiar or following the investments you guys have made previously, the Foundry Group, you're an investor in MakerBot, Zynga, Fitbit, Mobile Day, Techstars, of course. You've worked with 500 startups and their funding. And there's like a whole list. If you guys go to the AngelList page for Foundry Group's FG Angels, you'll see a lot of Brad's history there. I guess the first question I think a lot of people are asking, you've seen, and you kind of made a tongue-in-cheek reference to this when you announced that your involvement in this, is that there's been a lot of talk about this quote-unquote disrupting the VC industry. You are a VC investor yourself. What is your sense of what this is going to do? It sounded like you were getting into this to, sort of in the Yoda quote, to do rather than to just try doing it. You wanted to like learn from doing. Are you doing this because there is a lot of ambiguity around it, or do you think that this is actually a really opportunistic move for people in the VC space, and you want to be the first to leverage that?
I think fundamentally we believe that it's a great investment approach. So my partners and I have made a ton of seed investments historically, both, you know, with Foundry, through other vehicles, through Techstars. So we've got a philosophy and an approach to doing seed investing. It is a powerful approach, and rather than sit on the sidelines and watch it evolve, we thought we'd be deeply involved in both helping it evolve and understanding how it evolves and having that inform our long-term strategy. I'm not concerned about it displacing our traditional venture capital activity. I think it's complementary, additive, and I think it's phenomenal for entrepreneurs. Part of the reasons that I co-founded Techstars was to try to get more seed capital into the early stages of companies, get more advice and help and active mentoring at that seed stage, because my view is the more entrepreneurs who are enabled and have the resources to be able to get companies going will generate an increasing number of companies that then can scale and grow, many of which, you know, could scale without venture capital, some which will scale with venture capital. So I think it's just another part of the ecosystem, but one that is, you know, benefits from more capital and more energy.
I mean, reading some of your books, I mean, to kind of pick up on that point, you and your group are very focused on assistance and help and advice and mentoring and a sense of community. I mean, you have the book itself that's about startup communities. Do you think a piece of this has been missing in early stage? I mean, is it, you said that boosting this kind of stuff at the early stage is going to make the production of more companies possible. Do you think this is going to address this so-called Series A crunch then? Is that the perspective from that you're coming from?
No, I don't think it has anything to do with the Series A crunch, which, by the way, I think is a wonderful tagline that gets repeated over and over again in the context of trying to create some sort of mysterious imbalance in the ecosystem.
Yeah.
I'm much more interested in looking at it from the context of what life was like 25 years ago when I started my first company, actually now 28 years ago. And the process of raising money at inception when I was 21 years old, 19 years old when I started the company with a partner, but 21 years old when we actually had some thoughts about raising some money, which we never did, The incredibly opaque. We had no knowledge. We had no information. We had no idea what to do. And the dynamics between the venture capitalist or even just individual investors and the entrepreneurs were very imbalanced. So the entrepreneur had no information, they had no understanding of what to do, and they were really in a position where the investor side of the equation had a lot of, I don't want to say control in an inappropriate way, but again, this dynamic was very imbalanced. I think in terms of the evolution of entrepreneurship, the thing that is so important is to view the entrepreneur as the motive force and the investor as the fuel and support. And so, you know, over the last 15 years, and a lot of what we do at Foundry Group and a lot of what we do at Techstars is all around trying to be the fuel and support for entrepreneurs who are the ones that are actually creating and driving the business. And not just in some abstract BS PR type of way, you know, we're entrepreneur friendly and we love entrepreneur, whatever. I mean, everybody, you know, when you start asserting what you are, almost by definition, you're probably not that. So, you know, the venture capitalist who says I'm a value added venture capitalist is probably not a value added venture capitalist, right? The dynamic comes from some. So the end of this is, I view all of these tools, whether it be AngelList or accelerator programs like Techstars or active venture capitalists who engage at the early stages or active angel investors who engage at the early stages, or frankly, the plethora of information and services, BizSpark in and of itself, that are resources for companies at their inception, as a huge net positive to the entrepreneurial ecosystem. And as a venture capital investor, the more stuff that emerges, the better and more interesting life is.
Exactly. I mean, and when you look back in your history, one of the things that's very obvious is your father, for example, put you in touch with a gentleman who gave you a voice, I don't know what the appropriate term for it is, a voice computing piece of equipment, and you went home and tinkered with it and came up with ideas with it. People, as a guy named Peter Ewell says in our comment stream right now, take your book, Venture Deals, which I'm currently reading, and they pass it around because people want to take this information and make it free. And I think what you're saying is, quite rightly, the more we make this stuff accessible to people, the better the future is for everybody else, right? I mean, that's sort of the feel-good universal theme out of this.
It's feel-good, but it's fundamentally true. The value in the dynamic around entrepreneurship and creating and scaling companies is not the information asymmetry that exists between an investor and an entrepreneur. In fact, if you look at the dynamic, that information asymmetry in a lot of cases inhibits the development of companies more than it enhances them. What's so valuable is you view that information as something that's purely distributed that enables entrepreneurship anywhere in the world, right? You go on the web, you can read this stuff, you can watch these videos, doesn't matter where you are. That doesn't translate necessarily immediately into activity, but over time it creates more and more of a base. And the network that then gets built between entrepreneurs and investors, between investors and investors across the whole ecosystem at that early stage is what's so powerful.
And when you're talking to bootstraps, and we're talking to bootstraps a lot, I mean, we have an audience of about 16,000 people on this particular live channel, whether they watch it live or archived. Many of these people are people without resources, without funds, who are just trying to build something in a very critical time in their life. When you're talking about information that they should seek, do you have any pointers on where they should go for this information, but primarily what kinds of information is the most important and crucial for them to have to just get started? I mean, let's just say that someone's trying to build company X. Before they're even looking for funding, what should they have in their head before they even get ready to start?
So I think the most valuable thing is actually not getting particular pieces of information, but engaging in your startup community, wherever you live in the world, actively getting involved and being with other people who are doing entrepreneurship, who are creating companies, and who are working together and collaboratively in your geography. So there's now an enormous number of things like that that people can do at the inception of their companies that have nothing to do with fundraising, right? Startup Weekend is a great example of it. Startup Weekend, which, you know, was created in Seattle, and, you know, now is around the world. I think there will be about 800 Startup Weekends this year. Is a 50,
phenomenal,
right? 54-hour simulation of entrepreneurship. And it's not just great for aspiring entrepreneurs, but existing entrepreneurs, it's also great for, not just in terms of exercising muscle, but if you're an existing entrepreneur, you're looking for other people who are aspiring entrepreneurs to join your team early on. So it's a great place to recruit, meet other people. So doing stuff like that. The other thing I would say, and this is a mistake I see over and over again, ignoring the noise. Like, there's so much noise, and the noise, you know, gets to the level of insanity. I like to describe it as the People Magazine phenomena. you know, if all you read was People Magazine, and that was the only thing you read, you'd know some very specific and precise information that was generally useless, but allowed you to have cocktail party talk that was at a certain level. But the substance behind that in terms of how you would advance whatever you're doing in your life would be very limited. There's a ton of information on the web in the technology universe, especially sort of the classical media stuff that you see, that's the People Magazine equivalent. It's not that you shouldn't enjoy People Magazine. It's an okay guilty pleasure. I read it in the bathroom. let that be part of your information diet, but don't let that be your information diet. Don't let that dominate.
Do you think it makes sense for people to start, like, let's say that we have people, and we do, we have a lot of people who live in geographically isolated areas. People like you, people like Fred Wilson on the venture side of things got started really primarily by doing their own blogging. Do you recommend blogging for people as a way of reaching out for that community, of attracting those people to start those kind of things? Like the Fred's great blog, AVC, has a thriving comment community. Is that something that people should be spending their resources on to add a little bit more precise and accurate information to the ecosystems in their area?
Absolutely. I think, you know, whether you write a blog, whether you engage in the comments, whether you go to events, whether you create events, that engagement, that active doing, it's the same thing that we did, you know, we're doing with AngelList. I could write 20 blog posts about the potential implications of creating an AngelList syndicate and how that works. Why not just do it for a year and document that process and let people understand the easy parts of it, the good parts of it, the bad parts of it, and help work it out? Mm-hmm. You know, I often said Fred's a great example. I'm a good example. But how do you get Fred's attention? You don't get Fred's attention by sending Fred an email. Fred's, you know, said publicly many, many times, I can't deal with my email. And, you know, I get to some of it. And if it's important, I try to get to it. But don't count on me.
Yeah.
If you want his attention, leave a comment on his blog post. And this is key. Not once, but day after day after day. Engage in the community. If you're in a startup community, I don't care whether you're in Portland or Seattle or Boulder or Chicago or Austin or Mumbai, don't go to an event one time. Don't try to go to all the events. Pick a few things that are important and interesting to you and go month after month, week after week. Show up and participate. And that's the best way as a bootstrap entrepreneur, an early entrepreneur, an aspiring entrepreneur, frankly, an experienced entrepreneur, to get into the connective tissue of people that you can learn from.
What was some of the things that you did? I mean, when you look back at starting your own stuff and starting Techstars, can you think of a couple of crucial decisions that you made that you think made the difference between success and failure?
Sure. One is a thing that David Cohen and I, who's the CEO of Techstars, talk about all the time, which is be open to randomness.
Yeah.
The story of the creation of Techstars and the founding of Techstars is a very simple one. I'll take random meetings with people I don't know. And I sometimes do it in a structured way where I'll do it for an afternoon. Other times it's ad hoc. David got on my schedule. It took about 3 months for him to get on my schedule. We didn't know each other. He showed up in my office and started describing to me in a very sort of anxious way this idea for Techstars. He'd been a successful entrepreneur. I didn't know that. I didn't know him. He had made some angel investments. Turned out we had one together. He was very unsatisfied with how he was doing it, and he wanted to take a totally different approach. And he described what then became Techstars. And in about 10 minutes, my reaction was, I'm in. I'll toss in 50 grand. He had told me in that pitch he was going to put in $80,000 of his own money, and he wanted to raise a couple $100,000. And I said, I'm in for $50,000, as long as you're not a flake and a crook. And, you know, he said, well, if you're in for $50,000, my old partner in my other company, David Brown, might be in for $50,000. I'll call him. And I said, look, I'll call a friend of mine, Jared Polis, who happens to be now our unemployed congressman since the government shut down.
That's true. Yeah. Poor guy.
But Jared's a good friend. He's one of the unemployed congressmen who isn't taking a salary, thankfully. I think it's just crazy that people that our congressmen get paid for this.
Well, it's constitutionally protected, Red. Did you read this article on CNN? It said it said that it's constitutionally mandated that during a government shutdown, the congressman should be paid to avoid a government shutdown.
Yeah, it's just forget it.
But anyway, back to serendipity.
That was a bad path to go to. That's just ridiculous. Anyway, so just to give you a sense of the dynamics of be open to randomness, as I called Jared up. Jared, very successful entrepreneur, created BlueMountainArts.com and then created Provide Commerce, went public and got bought. And I called him up and said, hey, Jared, I'm tossing $50,000 into this thing called Techstars. Can I tell you about it? And his response was, yeah, Brad, I'm in for 50. What is it? Right. So it's this dynamic of letting yourself be open to new ideas and reacting quickly to them and not getting hung up on the, is this going to work or not work?
But this brings home a very interesting idea to me. And this is, to me, all around trust. How do you, whether you're investing in a team, a startup team like a Fitbit or whatever, or you're investing in someone's idea like Techstars, what are the triggers what are the things that trigger your trust receptors, basically? I mean, what did you find in David that you could trust, and what would you find in a team that you could trust where you can let that instinct kind of take its course? Because I imagine if we're talking about money, let's be frank, some of us have very conservative attitudes about money. And this kind of risk-taking is not, you know, let's not say it's inherent to everybody. I'd love to know how you've created a framework around trust.
Yeah, so the laissez-faire attitude of this example.
Bless you.
Excuse me, of this example, you know, drilling down is actually quite powerful. So David got introduced to me by somebody I trusted who knew him and had worked with him. I made the commitment to do it, and my comment to him was, as long as you're not a flake and a crook. So I then gave him some assignments as the next wave, which, by the way, included his partner, David Brown, putting money in. So there was built-in trust because other people that were around the system were willing to do something.
Yeah.
When somebody asks us how quickly we make an investment decision, it ranges from a day to a year. And it's not because we have a process that's a predictable process. Much of what we're trying to do is start by deciding if we like the idea or not. If the idea is within our themes, it's compelling, it fits, let's start with that. If we like the idea, then we go incredibly deep on the relationship with the people. Are these people that we want to work with, and do they want to work with us? And my three partners at Foundry, Jason, Seth, Ryan, and all, have pretty binary triggers on trust. We kind of have, you know, I have what I call the fuck me once rule. Like,
yeah,
right, you know, you can violate it one time, and one of us has to own it. Like, if I feel like I've been screwed over by you, I have to own it. I have to communicate it. But you get a yellow card in soccer, right? You're not thrown out of the game. I'm not done. But if it happens again, I'm done. Mm-hmm. And so entering the relationship, having some things that create a little bit of conflict, doing some things together early on, being open about the thing that's involved in this particular case, trust, is the starting point. And when it's violated, you just move on.
Well, let me bring. So a friend of mine, Mike, came back from Hong Kong. He's been living there. I've known him for 7 years, and I knew him when I lived in Hong Kong. He came to visit in San Francisco, and he has a health startup idea. And so the first question he asked me, and I think this is a question I've also heard in different forms from other people, is what do we do when the VC investor we approach wants to take 60, 70% of our company? Do you think that this is an idea that's actually pervasive in the VC community, that VCs are out just to own and control a company? And are there things like that that a founder should be watchful for if they do get a meeting with a big VC board or something like that?
So two things. One is, I think there's an enormous amount of mythology,
yeah,
about how VCs behave and what they want. And, you know, the one that you hear over and over again is that VCs are inappropriately greedy. They don't value the entrepreneurs, et cetera. And I think, sure, there are some that behave that way. But I think the general attribution is a weak attribution, because it tends to be very situation specific and, frankly, very VC specific, which leads me to the second and more important thing. There isn't a single archetype called a VC. There are lots of different archetypes. I actually, to make people understand it, I think of VCs as Dungeons and Dragons characters, which you look like you're old enough to know what a dungeon is.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Is that, you know, I have that conversation now. People look at me, what do you mean? And then I say, it's like a Magic the Gathering card. Oh, I know what that is, right? You know, you have orcs, and you have wizards, and you have mages, and you have dwarfs, and you have all kinds of different things. And they have different experience levels, and they have different spells and tools and strengths. And a venture capital firm is a collection of different Dungeons and Dragons characters. So the notion that there's a singular archetype, is the entrepreneur is doing him or herself a huge disservice, because one of the things that's powerful as an entrepreneur is to search out VCs and the VC archetypes that you're attracted to, that you want to work with, rather than stick them all in the same bucket.
And this was leading into my next question. What should a founder be prepared to even talk about in those meetings once they secure it? Because you obviously don't want to go into a VC meeting or an angel meeting with some kind of mythology about your own company. There is a difference between sort of having a good story and being transparent about who you are and going in there with a really great pitch and just trying to get their attention. Am I right? I mean,
absolutely right. And it varies dramatically by VC. So, for example, if somebody walks in to sit down with me for the first meeting, I don't want them to spend very much time telling me about what they're going to do and telling me about the size of the market and telling me and telling me and telling me. I want to play with the product. I want them to give me a demo. I want them to show me what they're doing. There are other VCs who, before they even care about the product, and maybe they don't even care about the product that much, they really want to understand the team, and they really want to understand the market space, and they really understand how you're going to go to market. And I think the key thing that's different in 2013 from, you know, 1987 and from mid-90s even, and even, you know, 2005, is that there is so much information about different VCs available, directly and indirectly. Directly available, you know, with the VCs that blog or stuff that's written or things that people talk about, and recognize that a lot of times when somebody's saying something, it's their own marketing, right? Everybody's got a shtick. I've got a shtick, whatever it is. You can decide what it is yourself. So try to separate again the substance from the noise. Does the person's words match their actions? And with many VCs, the words and the actions don't match up because the words are a lot easier than the actions.
Right.
But do your research, understand that. The second is use your network to learn about that VC, because you can find out who they've invested in. And if you can't via LinkedIn and via Crunchbase and via, you know, just basic web search, find a couple of other AngelList, find a couple of other entrepreneurs that'll talk to you about that investor. You're not working very hard to get that information.
And this is really, I mean, to be quite frank, this is one of the wonderful things about what AngelList has done, is I think that it has created this much more open platform for the people who are listed on this service to figure out who is linked to whom, which companies they've corresponded with, where they have a history, and actually being able to find out what the results of that history were. And I think I'm totally aligned with you in that kind of perspective of the more real information and narrative you have, the more confidence you can have in presenting your product to somebody of importance right there. I got to make a small break just to say we're watching the BizSpark show, and we have about 6 or 7 minutes left with Brad Feld. So if anyone out in the community wants to ask a question, we are taking questions. I do have some more questions of my own. We'll go right back to this conversation about community and about having faith and having trust in your conversations with investors. When it comes to technical things, Brad, when it comes to having a business plan, are there absolutely must-have ingredients to a business plan, whether you're talking to a Brad Feld or a Fred Wilson or Sequoia Capital or Andreessen Horowitz or whatever? If are there things that you must have that if they're missing, no one's going to give you the time of day?
So the answer is both no, and again, it varies by VC. I haven't looked at a physical business plan document in 20 years.
Wow.
Nor do I ever care to.
Why is that? Wait, do you think they're just BS?
Yeah. I am a show not tell person. I don't want you to tell me what you're going to do. I want you to show me what you're going to do. I want you to give me a feel for that product. I want you to be able to articulate it. I want you to give me a sense of it. We invest in areas that we know extremely well. So I don't need a 4-page market study of the competitive landscape and the total available market and what Gartner says. It doesn't matter to me. Some VCs care about that. So you have to understand that dynamic.
Got it.
You know, I think that for basic tools that every entrepreneur should have in their tool chest as they go into a fundraising process is, you know, a couple of paragraph in, you know, overview of the business. You should have a tight executive summary that's 1 to 4 pages that is really a proxy for the business plan, because that's the only stuff that you would put in a 40-page business plan that would be useful. And then I think you should have an up to 15, maybe at the outside, 20-page PowerPoint presentation that is the modern-day equivalent of what that business plan document would be. I don't need a financial model for an early-stage company, because the only thing I know is that whatever your financial model is, it's going to be wrong.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know the markets that we're investing in, so I know what the opportunity and the dynamics are, but at the early stages, it really doesn't matter very much. The one thing I would say, just as a footnote to all of that, be direct and be honest. The thing that turns off all the different archetypes of VCs is if somebody plays cat and mouse with them in terms of information, makes it hard to get the information, is like, you know, hinting about stuff but not laying it out there. And I'm not talking about, you know, what other VCs you're talking to or stuff like that, but just be direct about your product. You know, be direct about the business you're creating. If you think the VC has a conflict because of their portfolio, be upfront about that and have the VC say, no, I don't think that's a conflict.
If I got a meeting with you and I had a killer idea and I actually had tried to put together some kind of product, but I actually looked at you and said, Brad, I have no idea how I'm going to run this company or even if I'm going to be able to find a profitable model for it. Would you immediately close the door on me, or is there actually room for improvement there? Or there's no.
I'd say go work on that. Like, I wouldn't necessarily say what's the answer. I'd say what's your hypothesis? Create a fantasy. Define the fantasy, and the fantasy can be one that's unrealistic. But if I like you and I like the product, we can work through that. We can figure that out collaboratively.
Well, that's great. Well, it's really been great to talk to you, Brad. We've run out of time. We've had a lot of people watching, and I'm really happy that you joined us. So in the next few months, if people want to follow up with you, they can follow you on at Bfeld on Twitter. They can go to your blog. Hopefully they will go and buy your book. I want to buy the book to finish out my series. And I just want to say thank you. It's been a great conversation, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Delighted to be here, and I'm happy to get emailed too at brad@feld.com. So if there was anything unanswered or people want to follow up, just reach out.
Great. Thank you, Brad.
You're welcome.